Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. This is Alicia Keys playing Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata at the Memorial for Kobe Bryant on February 24th. A song at its core is a testimony, Keys writes in her new book. It's how we tell our stories, both individually and collectively. It's how we forget our troubles for a time and how we remember who we are emotionally. It's how we rally and how we heal. Well, this past Sunday night, Keys and other music stars rallied again, this time in the iHeart Living Room Concert for America, another major moment in a career already full of them. Alicia Keys is a 15-time Grammy winner, a classically trained musician, and a pop superstar. And she talks honestly about the challenges and hardships behind each of those accolades in her new book, More Myself. And she joins us now to talk about it. Alicia Keys, welcome to On Point.
You're so beautiful. Thank you so much. I was able to just listen to that and feel so uplifted by it. Thank you for having me.
Well, honestly, it's the music that lifts us up, I'd say. Listen, the whole world is going through something that none of us have ever been through before. And what we've been doing on this show is trying to check in with folks before we dive into an interview. So how have you been doing?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're doing well, we're healthy, and we're together, which I think is the theme of what I feel is happening right now. It's like there's a deep reset in regards to what you're thinking about, you know, what's important to you and what maybe we've even taken for granted. So we're doing well, and we're just working on keeping our spirits high and really just taking time to be with each other. And I think that we're doing well through it.
Yeah.
Thank you for asking. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. Thank you. Same. I mean, really taking the time when I get to go home to reconnect with my family. Our team is doing a terrific job from wherever they are right now. And so I think it's bringing out the best in everybody so far. Mm-hmm. But, you know, let me ask you, as a musician, like one of the core of what you do is connecting with people. I mean, at concerts, through music. What has that been like, not being able to have that kind of direct connection that you might have otherwise had during this time?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, that's, you know, even when you talked about the living room concert that just happened, that was even just a whole new experience. And whereas normally we would have gotten together and done that concert and been on a stage and played the song and somebody else would have come on next, you know, all those pieces are postponed. You know, they're not happening right now. But I think there was something also very powerful about being able to be there by myself, you know, just in my house, in my living room, in my space, and thinking about who's going to watch this and the people who are out here every day working to, you know, bring the very necessary things that we need right now. And so it just made it even more reflective and more poignant and more personal. And I think we can all testify that it's different not connecting directly with people in that way that we're so used to doing, but it's also somehow brought us closer. So mm-hmm. it's this weird dichotomy that's happening. So yes, it is very different for me as a performer in regards to normally that's what I feel is almost part of my purpose, being able to be in front of people, be close to people, be right there with you. And so to do this in a new way, obviously with technology, we still have the ability to do that. It's just so different.
Well, you know what? Let's listen to a little bit from that iHeart Living Room Concert for America. This is you playing Underdog.
So I sing a song for the hustlers trading at the bus stop, single mothers waiting on a check to come. become young teachers, student doctors, people on the front line knowing they don't get to run. This goes out to the underdog. Keep on keeping at what you love and you'll find that someday soon enough you will rise up, rise up. To the kitchen, talking to the driver about his children and wife, a first responder who is risking her life to give us a love and get it right on time. She looked in his eyes in a mirror and he smiled. One conversation, simple moment, the things that change us if we notice when we look up sometimes. They say I would never make it, but I was built to break the mold. The only dream that I've been chasing is my own.
That is Alicia Keys performing Underdog at the iHeart Living Room Concert for America. That sounds amazing. You did that from your house?
Oh. Yeah, that's from the... I mean, I have chills personally listening to that song. And, I mean, it's crazy because obviously I wrote the song, I played the song that day, but I don't know, right now it just feels so on time and I can't even believe how music does that for us. It's like I can't even believe that. Even as the creator of it, I'm still always so in awe of what the power of music has to really touch us and bring us through these times.
You're gonna rise it. You're gonna make it.
You write so beautifully about that, Alicia. You say a song, like no other art form, has the ability to curl up inside our spirits and never move out. I mean, I think that's exactly right. I mean, I was just thinking that it was only 7 weeks ago that you were, you know, helping L.A. and Kobe Bryant's, you know, many millions of fans try to heal from his death. That was just 7 weeks ago. Did you ever think that you would actually find yourself in this position of being not just a musician who heals, but like a healer with music?
Mm-hmm. Wow, I've been hearing that a lot. It's landed on me in a way that I know I can say no. I didn't exactly see it like that. I mean, I definitely know that I've always hoped for the intent, the purpose and the intention of me being able to have a platform to reveal itself and that over the years it surely has. But I think that in this time right now, more than ever before, it's reverberating and resonating for me too, because I think it's just because of this more openness that I am willing and ready to share and that I never was before. And now that I am more and I recognize the power there is in vulnerability and I recognize the power there is in being and discovering yourself for yourself, not based off of what everything has primed you to do or say or try to become. There's a power in that. And because I think I'm understanding that more, it's leading me and us to a connection that we just weren't ever able to have before, even though we've connected in so many ways mm-hmm. over the years. And of course we have, but now it just feels like a whole different space that's happening. And so when you use that word like a healer or use that word, like I almost have to remind myself to accept it, you know, mm-hmm. and that's something that I constantly work through. And that's a lot of what this book is about, is working through that you are allowed to become greater and greater and better and better. And that we don't have to shy away from that or feel like we don't deserve that or, you know, push that away. And so when you say that to me, it's another practice for me to be able to say thank you and to be able to say that I am ready to show up like that. I am grateful that I have that opportunity to provide that type of energy for people, and that means something to me. So thank you.
Well, you're more than welcome. and I hear you when you say that, like, in your book you talk about the sort of constant... practice is the word you use, that you've undergone in your whole life to accept not only the gifts, but the responsibilities of your talents as well. But there is something else you said. I just want to ask you quickly before we have to take a little break here. Musicians, performers of any kind, part of how they connect so deeply with their fans is they're willing to be vulnerable, right, on stage and like kind of just say, here's who I am, here's what I have to offer. I feel like that's one of the reasons why all of us are maybe connecting with each other in a different way now, because whether we want to or not, we're all forced to realize our vulnerabilities at this moment. And that's why, like, I've been listening to more music. I know lots of people I know have. Is there something that we're all kind of beginning to understand here that you've known by virtue of having to be on stage for so many years already?
That's a great question. Wow. I mean, I think there's definitely, wow, that's so funny. There's definitely, I always said that I never read reviews because, like, I'm like, until you can get up here and do what I'm doing, don't talk to me about it.
Yeah.
And because especially when people want to say negative things or whatever. So I think that there is this beautiful equalizing of us all, like, having to show our bruises and show our fears and sit in our anxieties and that self-doubt and all of that stuff that actually, you know, before I step on a stage, so much of that is going through my head. What if I don't do it? What if I don't make it? What if I'm not good today? What if it doesn't go the way that I hoped it would? What if I mess up? Mm. What if this goes away? Whatever the case. And so I think that this is a beautiful thought that you have about all of us sitting in this place of just like, here we all are, and we are who we are, and we have to feel all the things that we feel, and they're all going to be right there present, and we have to figure our way through it.
We are talking with the one and only Alicia Keys this hour. We'll be right back. This is On Point. We are here for all of us. That's why we are here. Why we are here. We are here. Oh, 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 we are here.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast. I keep on falling in and out.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and of course, that is Alicia Keys from her 2001 album Songs in A Minor. It's Fallen, and we are talking with Alicia Keys this hour. She's got a new book out. It's called More Myself.
I keep on falling in and out of love with you.
I'm smiling and I'm laughing here, Alicia, because you are one of those musicians that literally every time I hear a song that you've made, regardless of when it comes from your career, I'm like, how did she do that? Do you ever wonder that about yourself?
Actually, I wonder about songs all the time. I'm always in awe of a song. Like, it doesn't matter how it happened, how it came together, in what way it happened differently all the time. And every time I am looking at it like, I can't believe it exists. Like, I truly, truly feel like that every song.
Well, good. I'm glad I'm not alone, because I'm like, God, you were so talented from the start, so young, and just had so much to give. But you tell this, the reason why I think the book is pretty special is because you talk about how hard it was and the challenges. And in fact, you open the book pretty much with a really kind of a tough story about a photo shoot that you had to do really early in your career. I'm wondering, could you tell that story to us?
Yeah, basically, it was one of those times at the very beginning when, you know, there was a very special, credible magazine that was willing to feature me and put me on the cover. And it was very exciting, obviously, that none of the music had really come out. We had just started maybe with Fallen and another song that came before that called Girlfriend. And it was, you know, it was really, really at the beginning. And to be able to make it on a cover like this was a big deal and really said a lot to the tastemakers, said a lot to just the industry and to people like that. I was arriving and everybody was very excited about it, and I was excited about it. And so when we get there, everything is cool and all the people are there, and the photographer eventually asked all the people to step out of the room. And I figured that, and I hadn't done a lot of photo shoots, but I figured like that was pretty normal and just wanted some privacy, and I got it. And so that was, I thought, fine. But as the process went, kind of got a little bit more risque in the sense of, I mean, he never approached me or anything. There was never nothing that happened that way. But it was kind of like, can you kind of, how about we take off the shirt and you cover it with your hands only? Or how about we kind of pull down, that we're not going to take the pants off, we're just going to pull them down a little on this side. And I remember being in that shoot, you know, I don't know, about, I don't know, 18 years old, 17 years old, something like that. And I felt so uncomfortable. I was like, this is not the vibe. Like, I don't. But I'm like, but he knows better, doesn't he? I mean, he shoots all these amazing people all the time. And I, you know, ended up with a photograph that to this day, it makes me cringe because I totally, you know, I just was out of my element. I was not in my place of comfort. And it was one of the biggest lessons for me from the beginning about really knowing that if you are uncomfortable with something, you have to speak up right away, because I have to protect myself. Nobody's going to protect me except me. And people have their own agendas and they have their own sensationalized moments that they're trying to create. And I remember wanting to rip that magazine cover off of every newsstand in the whole world so I could just like never feel the embarrassment that I felt from kind of finding myself in a place I promised myself I'd never be in again.
Yeah. I'm hoping, though, that looking back now, that the Alicia Keys of today can forgive or has forgiven the Alicia Keys of 2001, because you were just a teenager, like you said. How are you supposed to know?
Yeah, I mean, of course. Honestly, it had to happen, and I'm grateful for the experience, because if it hadn't happened, I learned very early, very quickly. And it was, you know, although, yes, of course, did I feel uncomfortable about the look of the photograph, but nothing happened to me. Nobody violated me. It was only because I didn't put up boundaries, you know. And so I think that it really was imperative for me to learn that lesson quickly, because who knows how that would have manifested in another way had I not learned very quickly that when you're in these spaces, you got to protect yourself and make sure that you are doing what you feel comfortable with, because at the end, it's only you, you know. So I definitely forgive myself. I don't hang on to it anymore. I'm grateful for the lesson that it taught me.
Right. Well, and I guess I wonder if it was also a really early lesson in that would you have to fight for maintaining control of the image of yourself that you wanted to present to the public?
Absolutely. That's a constant fight. Yeah. That was the beginning of understanding that, because people will definitely, and you find that in this space of artistry or this particular entertainment industry, you know, it's a very delicate balance between art and commerce, you know? And so people will constantly be trying to push you towards what they think will be better for the commerce over the art. And so I think that oftentimes I've had to always recenter and always remind myself that I know what I want from this, and I want it to be something that I love and I am proud of and something that reflects me properly, you know, and that's a constant thing, because who we are constantly also shifts and it grows and it evolves. So in new times, we're experiencing new things. So that definitely was the beginning of that fight in many ways that I've had to have over the time of just demanding to stay in my center.
Yeah. Well, I'd love to hear another story that you tell in the book. And this one's just fantastic. And it's about how Clive Davis, who was leading the label that you were with at the time, you were wondering, like, why wasn't the music, like, getting the kind of traction that it absolutely deserved? So he calls up his friend, Oprah, and says, well, you tell the story because it's remarkable. So what happened when Clive Davis called up Oprah?
Well, basically, the song was Fallen, and Fallen was always a bit off the beaten path. You know, it really wasn't, although now we know the song and people can sing it and everybody knows it, at the beginning, it was definitely not similar to any other music. And one would think that, in retrospect, now that you can look at it from this side, you could say, oh, well, that's why it broke through. But it took a long time, and it really wasn't meant to break through. Like, people were not wanting it to come in. It's because it's, with radio, you play things that sound like each other, so you can do blends in the radio format flows. And so it's a natural thing that if it doesn't sound like anything else you're playing, it's very hard for you to slot it. It's hard for you to put it in. And so we were coming up against a lot of that. And then I was only 18 years old, but here's this mature sounding record with all this pain and passion, and they were like, "Well, what is she, 70? Like, what is this person?" And so it wasn't until they actually could lay their eyes on me and know that there was this beautiful mixture of, here's a young girl with cornrows and, you know, from the street, and also has this soulfulness to her that they could start understanding. So we realized very quickly, and he realized quickly, people had to see me perform to really understand what it was and what the magic was. And so that was what provoked him to make this call and say, you know, you've done this for different young book writers, and you've featured people for book writers to have an opportunity to spread their work. Could you do this for a new artist? And that's when the show came back and said that they would love to do that, and that they would like to feature a few young artists in this world that is emerging. And that's when the show was put together. And it really was that special call that he made, and that idea that changed everything. Because once people saw me and they saw this 18-year-old girl with the cornrows and the little penguin tails that I had on, with my Swarovski crystal sneakers, playing some Mozart and moving into Fallen, they got it, and they could see why this was something that was special. So it's such an honor for me, and now this book is actually their first book released on her, Miss Oprah's imprint, and it is so full circle and so powerful the way life goes. It's unbelievable.
Well, I mean, it's safe to say that, like, you practically walked out of Oprah's studio into a completely different life after that.
Oh, my gosh. So here's this girl from Hell's Kitchen who just always was super rough around the edges, walking down these dark streets. And here I go, getting back on the plane from Chicago, going back to Hell's Kitchen. And every single person in the airport was like, wait a minute, are you... did I just see you on the Oprah show? Hold on. Is your name? And I couldn't, but it was the craziest sensation. It was like a movie. It was literally a movie. I never expected that. And they were from the gambit. It was like, you know, a young black woman from Chicago to an old white man who was 70 years old saying the same thing. It was so crazy to see the spectrum of the audience that was introduced to me through that show. And it was never the same after that.
Yeah. Well, you know, that's not only a testament to the power and reach of Oprah Winfrey, but also that people were responding to your music, I have to say. So let's take a moment to listen to a little bit more of your debut studio album. Again, this was way back in 2001, Songs in A Minor. This is How Come You Don't Call Me.
Anymore.
How Come You Don't Call Me by Alicia Keys from back in 2001. And of course, Alicia, you had to call up someone special to get permission to do this song, right? Can you tell us that story?
That right there is Baby Keys. I love hearing that music. It's so cool. And yes, so basically what happens is when you are covering a song, you have to get permission from the songwriter to put it on an album that's going to be sold. Like, you have to get permission for them. And even if it's not going to be sold, you have to get permission. So I found myself in a hotel room. I was doing these really intimate, only piano, only little small press things. And here I was in a hotel room, and I had to get on the phone with one of the people I've admired my whole life, Prince.
I keep your picture beside my bed. And I still remember everything you said.
Like, how do you get on the phone with Prince? Can anybody tell me what to do when you, like, what does that sound like? So I, you know, they gave me a number, and I'm like so nervous. I mean, so nervous. I have to ask this guy who has notoriously turned down people from covering his stuff, and I know this. And so I'm going to ask him again anyway, if maybe by chance he'll clear this one for me. And so as the phone call starts, I call the number, and somebody picks up. They say, hold on. They transfer me again. Someone else picks up. They say, hold on. They transfer me again. By the third and fourth time of the transfer, my nerves were shot. Like, I thought I had it together. I thought I could explain what I was saying. By the time he picked up the phone, I was a mess. And so I was just, like, trying to find the words. He was really gracious. He was saying how he heard that I wrote and produced all my music, and was really proud of me for doing that, to keep that up. And I told him that I love this song, How Come You Don't Call Me, and I covered it for my first album, and would he be okay with me using it? And he was like, well, why don't you come to Paisley Park and perform it for me, and we can talk more about it there. And I was in shock. Of course, who doesn't want to go to Paisley Park to meet Prince and perform his song for him? And that's how it went, and we started a friendship there, and it's something that was a really important mentorship for me.
Wow. I mean, it's such an awesome story, I have to say. But it's also, it shows, like, how much was happening in your life in such a short period of time, right? How did you cope with that?
You know, a lot of the times I just, you know, similar to growing up in the streets of Hell's Kitchen, I did a post the other day. I've been doing some beautiful posts on my Instagram, just really kind of sharing some of these deeper stories, and I've been pulling out the pictures that can go along with them. So definitely check those out, because it's great, and it really goes even deeper. Growing up in the streets of Hell's Kitchen, a lot of the times I realized I grew up around, you know, pimps and prostitutes, drug dealers. That was the neighborhood at the time. And I remember the first time I saw the women on the street, I asked my mother, what are they doing there when it's so cold? And how come they don't have coats on? And she tried her best to explain to me what that was. And I realized that even just seeing them in that state made me so put on my own armor at the young age of 6 years old, and realized that I didn't want to be exposed and powerless. And I think that a lot of the time throughout my life, I've held on to that armor of not being exposed, not being vulnerable, not being powerless. And that's what I had to do to power through a lot of these experiences. Even as I transitioned into the industry, I put my mask on, I put the armor on, and I just go. And I found over the years that I've had to undo that mask and undo that armor so that I can get more in touch with these parts that are so important to be familiar with, the vulnerability and those parts that make us up who we are. Mm. But that's how I got through it. I put that armor on, I put that mask on, and pretended like I knew what I was doing, even when I mostly didn't. And I kept going as fast as I could.
Well, you write that early on in your career, you learned you no longer belong to yourself. You said, quote, I'd become captive to every request, every demand, every surge of fear that came with even the thought of saying no. I delivered my grandest performance yet, convincing the world that behind my smile, it was always perfect as it appeared. Well, we got to take a quick break. We have a lot more to talk about with Alicia Keys when we come back, and we'll go into the break with No One, of course. This is from her 2007 album, As I Am. It's one of the best songs. I love this song, so let's hear more of it. We'll be right back.
I just want you close.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We are talking this hour with Alicia Keys. She's, of course, the 15-time Grammy Award-winning singer and songwriter. She's got a new book out. It's called More Myself.
Now you're in New York. These streets will make you feel brand new.
And this is Empire State of Mind Part 2 from 2009, The Element of Freedom, of course, with Jay-Z. And Alicia, I'm going to ask you to tell us about this song in a little bit, because I want to come back in the end of our conversation to sort of your thoughts about your hometown right now. But Alicia, if we could, let's continue on with some of the stories that you tell in the book. Because you do really honestly write about how there came a point in time in your career where you just, like, needed to step back. It wasn't even just a break. Like, you call it a jailbreak. What happened?
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, there was just a time when we left talking about this armor. We left talking about this mask, and I got very used to realizing that I had to work hard, work fast, work long. And I knew how to outwork everybody and everything, and I knew how to, you know, I was never thinking about how to take care of myself or if it was good for me or if it was, you know, if maybe one less thing would be better. You know, I wasn't even thinking like that. I was in a place where this was the dream that I'd had my whole life. And here I was smack in the middle of potentially really being able to have it. And I just felt like I owed everybody everything. And it was never about, you know, being good to myself. So after years of that and continuing to do that between the first album and the second album and back-to-back performances all the time and endless kind of commitments and engagements that I never put space into and that I felt almost obligated to do or else for fear of things disappearing or people becoming angry or not promoting the things that I was putting out. You know, there were all these kind of manipulations and things that I found myself in the middle of. And I just went on and on at that pace, at that fever, and with that type of consciousness. So in a way, I was really operating from a huge place of fear because I didn't know any better. And so after years of that, I just started to lose myself. I started to lose the understanding of who I was and what I wanted and what was good for me. And and it just became a blur, and I didn't know what to do with it anymore. And I felt totally overwhelmed, and I had to make the jailbreak. And that's why I actually, for the first time, took a really important trip where I actually went to Egypt. And it was the first time I went somewhere by myself, and really it was for myself. And I'd never done that before. And that's why I call it kind of the jailbreak, because then somehow I found myself, I incarcerated myself with all of these fears and thoughts that I thought I had to do for people.
Well, in the book, you write how you took your keyboard with you to Egypt, and you say, nothing fine-tunes one's ability to listen, to deeply hear, like forced silence. I took in the sounds around me, playing the ancient pentatonic chords of the Egyptian scale, and each note was a meditation, tranquility wedged between the keys. Tell me more about why being in Egypt on your own brought you that kind of meditative state.
Yeah, it was crazy. It was literally like I got off the plane into this foreign space, and actually one of the things that was arranged was this kind of, you know, sail down the Nile, and it was just so stunning. And so I thought, oh, I'll bring my keyboard, and can you imagine, you're sailing down the Nile for 3 days, and I can play, and I can sing, and what would that do for me? I was just so thrilled and so excited, and that daggone keyboard is so clunky, and trying to get it in the room and everything, and it got in there and set it up, and there I am in this place, and literally my voice starts to go, just go, laryngitis. I don't know what it was. It would not work. I couldn't talk. It went totally away. And it was unbelievable. And at first I was so frustrated because I'm like, come on, man, this is the dream that I was after. And then as I sat with it for some time, I realized that I needed to not talk. I needed to just look around. I needed to not sing. I needed to not do anything. I just needed to be silent and quiet. And maybe in a way that's where we are now.
Well, obviously, that trip, it was like, is it safe to say it was kind of a life-changing moment? Because you memorialized that trip even by naming one of your children Egypt, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was definitely, for sure, a life-changing moment. I mean, you know, all the things I was able to see, all the ancient wonders, and even just the, you know, when you go there, there is, you can't even believe that things like this have been built, and not only been built, but been built thousands of years ago. It is definitely, it was a testament to all that is possible to create. And I really needed that message at the time. I needed to know that I could create anything I could possibly imagine, and I didn't have to continue on this path of doing what I thought was right or what I thought people would accept of me or what they wanted from me. Instead, I could create this whole beautiful world that could be huge and magnificent. And that was the first time that ever dawned on me. So that was definitely a life-changing trip.
Wow. Well, let's listen to a little bit more of your music here. Everyone's going to know this as soon as we play it. You wrote this song, what, just right after you gave birth to your first son. And as you write, like, you pretty much knew right away that there was something special about it. So let's just hit it first. Girl on Fire from 2012. Can you tell me about what it was like writing this song?
This song was something else. A lot of the times I find that, you know, people may know me for songs that are quite empowering and even, you know, for women specifically, like Superwoman or A Woman's Worth, or, you know, when this song came around, Girl on Fire, which was just such a massive message of standing in your power. But the reason why I started writing that song is because I was actually looking around at the women around me and noticing just the power within a woman, even through all the struggle and through all the difficulties and the challenges and the hard times, and you know, and I just saw this resilience And that's why there are these words of you know, the world is kind of like crashing around us, but we're gonna stand resilient in it. And it felt like that, and it feels like that still in so many ways. So this song was so beautiful because it happened in this magic way that songs do, that I said I stand in awe of. And it just kind of started to pour together and come together in these words. Looks like a girl, but she's a flame so bright she could burn your eyes. Better look the other way. And it was more of a reminder to myself and a reminder to the women that I was around that we are going to make it through, you know? And that's where a lot of these songs come from, that need to just be reminded my own self that we're going to make it through. So that was the feeling around the song. And when it kind of developed into what it, you hear it is now, I remember I was like, I hurried and I called Swiss right away. And I was like, I think we have something here. It was so palatable. It was so special. It was just booming out of the speakers saying these words. And I'll never forget how I knew right from the jump that it was just something that we all needed to hear.
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned your husband, right? Swiss Beats. And you've got a blended family with him. And you've even got a song that tells that story. So let's listen to this. This is Blended Family from the 2016 album Here. That's Blended Family from 2016. Alicia, you write a lot in your book, More Myself, about family. Obviously about your family now, about your grandmother, your mother.
Yeah.
Can you tell me about like how you had to work to keep family center as your career like kept, you know, heading towards the stratosphere?
It wasn't really until we started to have our own family that I really understood. That's when things... People ask me, like, when was that biggest change for you that really started to center you and that you could start to recognize more of yourself? And I think that it was after Egypt was born. Even before Egypt was born, I remember getting really, you know, that whole thing that they say about how you start spring cleaning. It wasn't only in the house. It was, like, in my life. I finally started to realize, like, man, I don't have time for negative energy. I don't have time for people that are draining me. Because they're going to drain this baby. And I don't have time for, like, anything but what's going to protect this baby. And I remember that really being a very important moment for me because I, myself alone, wasn't strong enough to take at the time to take care of myself. But through the baby and for my strength of being a first-time mom, I became better to myself. And that, I found, was... for his sake. And I found that that was the beginning of me recognizing and starting to set boundaries and starting to create, you know, just speaking up and realizing, like, you know what, that's not really good for me right now. And no, I don't want to be away for 2 weeks from my newborn. Like, I don't. It's just not that important to me. What's more important is actually cultivating relationships and becoming deeper and being a present parent and being a present partner. And these type of things started to make me understand the boundaries or understanding how to create balance between the work life and the family life. I guess I didn't have a need for that balance prior, or I just didn't understand or wasn't ready to create it. But that's what started to make me be able to have more of a balance in my life.
Yeah. You know, As I'm sure you know, in Beyoncé's Homecoming, she talks about the same thing, right? About how, you know, now being mother of three, like her priorities really did shift. She talks about how trying to balance that as she's trying to put together this amazing show. And what I'm wondering is, for superstars like her, like you, I mean, it's hard enough for any woman, but then you have the pressure of the expectation of millions of fans too. Like, how did you balance that?
That's definitely a tricky one, you know, this idea of validation and this idea of, you know, people liking what you do or not liking what you do, judging what you do is a big one. And, you know, now more and more we probably find ourselves face to face no matter who we are, even if we're just a 13-year-old girl in, you know, junior high. If we have a phone and if we have a, you know, a social media page, you know, there's going to be somebody that's not going to like what you do or what you say or what you post or whatever the case is. And so I think that there's a big piece of everything that does circle around, and a big piece of becoming more of yourself on my journey that has circled around really understanding that you have to create what you create. You have to believe what you believe. You have to feel what you feel and express how you express, because you know that that's what works for you and what you need to say and what you are learning and how you're growing, and you need to share it without that added pressure of what will people like it or not, and if they don't like it, should I not say it or not do it or not write it or not dance it or not paint it? You know, it's like, and it's very, very hard because we are all looking for approval. Mm-hmm. We really are. Yeah. You want that. But it's almost impossible to really be who you are and stand for whatever it is that you stand for if you're sitting here looking for every single body to approve of it. And I am very familiar with this, by the way, very, because I spent a lot of time wanting people to approve what I was doing. And it's a really tricky road. And so I think that part of it is just realizing that not everybody's going to like everything. And as long as you're being, you know, honest and truthful to yourself, and also presenting it in a way that's thoughtful and kind. I mean, there's also a way you can do things that just not being thoughtful about it, but that's not what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
As long as you're doing things that are meaningful to you, then that's what's important. And everything else, you got to have a thick skin, and you got to be able to just stand behind what you're giving.
Right. Well, you know, Alicia, we've got just about a minute left, and I want to circle back to where we started about the moment that we're all in right now and the vulnerabilities we all feel. But thinking specifically about your hometown, about New York, you know, one of the epicenters right now of America's battle against coronavirus. Like, what's your message? What do you want your fellow New Yorkers to hear and feel and know right now?
Wow. That we're all together and, you know, for the first time ever, we can all understand each other. And I think that we're all going through our own set of challenges and our own set of struggles, and it's definitely difficult. But I see the power within us. And, you know, with this challenge, we also get to be the solution. And I think that we also get to be a light source. And even though there are going to be days that you feel down, there's going to be days that you feel great, there's going to be days that you feel uncertain, scared, all these things, you know, allow yourself the space to feel that. That's natural. But also know that the light that you give your daughter, your son, your husband, your wife, the people you're in the space with, and also through our social medias and being able to connect with people on our Zooms and all the ways we're trying to connect right now, the light that we can give really is infectious, and it doesn't cost a thing. And I think let's be that for each other, and we're going to find our way through it.
Well, Alicia Keys, 15-time Grammy Award winner. There's a new album coming out later this year. Her new book is called More Myself. Alicia, it's been really terrific and joyful to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
You too. I loved it. Thank you for being so thoughtful, so introspective, and bringing all these things out. I loved how it all flowed together.
Good. I'm glad. Any excuse we can make to play Alicia Keys music during On Point, we will do it. So let's go out of this hour with In Common from Alicia's 2016 album, Here. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point. We got way too much in common. If I'm being honest with you, we got way too much in common. Since I'm being honest with you, who wants to love somebody like me? You want to love somebody like me? If you can love somebody like me, you must be messed up. Love somebody like me. You wanna love somebody like me. If you can love somebody like me, you must be.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices. And they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons. And there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.